Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So, you know, we carry a lot of things with us throughout our lives, right? Like memories, habits, maybe a lingering joint issue from an old sports injury. Something.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
But for like over 90% of the global human population, you also carry this quiet, microscopic passenger, which is the Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV.
Right, which is wild when you think about it, 90%.
Yeah, and most of the time you don't even know it's there. It just, you know, remains completely silent in your B cells.
Yeah.
But in a small, really unfortunate subset of people, this dormant virus just wakes up, and it radically alters the host's cellular machinery, driving these highly aggressive, treatment-resistant blood cancers.
It really is a devastating biological pivot. You go from having this silent, latent passenger to, well, a primary driver of a truly relentless malignancy. And the clinical reality for patients facing these EBV-driven lymphomas is incredibly grim, because these hijacked cells, they become exceptionally adept at evading like our best medical interventions.
Right, they just adapt to everything. But what if we could flip a single molecular switch that selectively triggers these hijacked, drug-resistant cancer cells to self-destruct, all while leaving the completely healthy cells, you know, entirely untouched?
I mean, that sounds like the holy grail of oncology, right?
It really does. But the molecular biology we are examining today, it maps out exactly how that targeted mechanism might actually function in the real world.
Well, today we celebrate the work of Maria C. White, Philip T. Lunge, Jessica Stewart, and Blossom Demania from the Leyenberger Comprehensive Cancer Center and the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who have advanced our understanding of how the cellular protein NEK2 drives pathogenesis and drug resistance in EBV-positive non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
Exactly. And just to place this into the broader scientific record for you guys, this research was published in PNAS, so the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in May 2026.
Yep, a very solid publication.
Yeah. So our mission in this deep dive is to sort of map the exact molecular pathways EBV uses to hijack our cells and, you know, explore whether turning off a single host protein could revolutionize how we treat multi-drug-resistant cancers.
To fully grasp the magnitude of the shift, we really have to look at the battlefield first. Non-Hodgkin lymphoma, or NHL, it represents roughly 90% of all malignant lymphomas globally. And its incidence just continues to rise.
Wow, 90%.
Yeah, it's massive. But it is not a monolith, though. It's a highly diverse group of blood cancers. And a specific subset, so including things like Burkitt lymphoma, post-transplant lymphoproliferative disorders, and NKT cell lymphomas, those are directly linked to EBV infection.
Right. And when you look at the standard of care for these EBV-positive lymphomas, it is essentially a war of attrition.
That's a good way to put it.
The current therapies, you know, they can be efficacious, but they rely heavily on systemic toxicity. You are dosing the patient with these harsh chemotherapeutics, just hoping to eradicate the malignancy before the side effects cause, like irreversible organ damage or catastrophic immune suppression.
And that war of attrition frequently fails because of acquired multi-drug resistance.
Right, the cancer learns.
Exactly. A patient endures this grueling, highly toxic chemotherapy regimen, and the cancer simply adapts. It basically alters its protein expression to deflect or expel the drugs, so it leaves the clinical team with almost zero viable secondary options. The tumor survives, and the patient just suffers all that toxicity for nothing.
That's awful. They give you a relatable way to visualize this pathology. Imagine EBV as a permanent house guest.
Okay, I like this.
Yeah, usually this guest just stays quietly in the spare room, doesn't eat much, goes entirely unnoticed, but occasionally some trigger occurs. The guest completely takes over the house, barricades the front doors, and starts hoarding all the physiological resources.
Yep, eating all the food.
Exactly. And you can't just politely ask them to leave anymore. So standard therapies are like trying to burn the entire house down just to get rid of the guest.
That analogy hits the mark perfectly regarding how entrenched the virus becomes. And to dismantle those barricades, the research team realized that attacking the virus directly is historically, well, ineffective.
Because viral genomes are so small, right?
Right. They can be incredibly small and elusive. So instead, the researchers turned their focus to the human host's own cellular machinery, specifically the genome, which is the vast network of kinases that the virus was actively exploiting to reinforce its position.
Okay, so they zeroed in on a specific kinase, right, NEK2. And we know any K2's usual day job is regulating centrosome separation during the cell cycle, basically making sure chromosomes divide correctly during mitosis.
Exactly, it's a cell division protein.
But the researchers had previously noticed this massive anomalous overexpression of NEK2, specifically in EBV-positive lymphomas, whereas it was like nearly undetectable in normal, healthy, resting B cells.
Right, and to map how entrenched this viral houseguest truly gets, the team couldn't just look at the final chaotic environment of a fully formed tumor.
Too many variables.
Way too many. They had to rebuild the molecular crime scene from scratch to isolate those variables. So they started with naive human primary B cells. These are completely healthy cells that had never encountered EBV. And they infected them with the virus in a controlled environment to track the immediate canonic response.
And they saw the NEK2 expression spike almost immediately upon primary infection, didn't they?
They did. But to prove the virus was the sole architect of that spike, they actually ran the experiment in reverse, too.
Oh, that's smart. How so?
They took EBV-negative lymphoma cells and transfected them with specific viral latency proteins.
Okay, so these are the specialized tools the virus uses to manipulate the host environment while staying mostly hidden from the immune system.
Exactly. They isolated three specific viral latency proteins, EBN1, EBNA2, and LMP1. And what they discovered is that introducing any one of these three proteins independently drives that dramatic upregulation of NEK2 in the host cell.
Wow, so it's redundant.
Highly redundant. The virus isn't just incidentally benefiting from NEK2, right? It is actively redundantly ensuring that this host protein is overproduced. It relies on it as a critical survival mechanism.
So once they identified NEK2 as basically the central pillar holding up the virus's barricade, they introduced this highly specific, irreversible pharmacological inhibitor called JH295.
Yes.
And this molecule, it's designed to covalently bind to NEK2 and just permanently shut down its catalytic activity.
The breadth of their testing with JH295 is what builds such a compelling case here. I mean, they didn't just isolate a single cell line. They deployed this inhibitor alongside advanced genetic depletion techniques, utilizing CRISPR-Cas9 to physically knock out the NEK2 gene.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they did this across 8 distinct lymphoma cell lines, encompassing the Burkitt, post-transplant, and NKT cell variants.
The methodology here is really rigorous, especially their use of coisogenic cell lines.
Oh, definitely.
Because to absolutely confirm that the NEK2 vulnerability is tied to the viral hijacking, they used pairs of genetically identical cell lines where the only variable was the presence or absence of EBV, right?
All right.
Because if JH295 simply poisons everything, both cell lines would die equally.
Right. Isolating that exact variable revealed a staggering discrepancy. The EBV-positive cells were significantly more susceptible to apoptosis, so programmed cell death, when exposed to the NEK2 inhibitor than their EBV-negative counterparts.
That's huge.
It is. By over-relying on NEK2 for its hyperactive growth, the virus inadvertently created this massive targetable vulnerability. The very pillar it built to protect itself became its fatal flaw.
But wait, I want to challenge one specific aspect of their in vitro methodology, though.
Sure. What is it?
They deliberately took healthy primary B cells, chemically stimulated them to proliferate rapidly, and then hit them with the JH295 inhibitor. Why deliberately force healthy cells to mimic cancer's rapid division before testing the drug?
That is a great question. It is a critical control for addressing the exact clinical problem with standard oncology. Because traditional chemotherapies are, by design, blunt instruments.
Right.
They target the basic mechanics of cellular division, meaning they kill any cell that is dividing quickly. That is precisely why cancer patients lose their hair, suffer severe gastrointestinal distress, and experience, you know, life-threatening immune suppression. Because healthy hair follicles, gut lining, and immune cells all rely on rapid division.
So the chemotherapy is essentially a carpet bomb, just indiscriminately destroying anything that moves fast.
Precisely. So by taking healthy human cells, forcing them to proliferate rapidly, and applying JH295, the researchers were asking a pivotal question: is this inhibitor just another carpet bomb, or is it a sniper rifle?
Oh, I see.
And the data showed that the rapidly dividing healthy cells largely survived the exposure to JH295. This proves the drug's incredible precision. It confirms it isn't killing cells merely because they are in the cell cycle. It is destroying them specifically because they are metabolically addicted to that hijacked NEK2 pathway.
That distinction is paramount. And to understand exactly how the sniper rifle works, we have to look at the mechanism of cell death. Because JH295 doesn't just, you know, quietly put the cancer cells to sleep.
No, not at all.
It induces what is characterized as an inflammatory cell death. It triggers this massive accumulation of reactive oxygen species, specifically hydrogen peroxide, inside the cancer cell. It's almost as if the cell is suddenly rusting from the inside out due to extreme oxidative stress.
Let's explore why that happens, actually. Reactive oxygen species, or ROS, they are natural byproducts of cellular metabolism. But EBV-positive cancer cells are running incredibly hot. Their metabolic rate is just hyperactive to sustain rapid tumor growth.
Right, they're in overdrive.
Normally, a cell has scavenger systems to neutralize those toxic byproducts. Well, NEK2 apparently plays a vital, previously underappreciated role in buffering that immense oxidative stress in these specific tumors.
So when JH295 covalently binds and shuts down NEK2, you completely remove that buffer.
Exactly. The hydrogen peroxide rapidly accumulates to completely lethal toxic levels.
Which brings us to gastrumin D. We know gastrumin D is usually an executioner protein in the innate immune system, right? Mm-hmm. It's utilized to trigger pyroptosis, which is this fiery inflammatory death that alerts the surrounding immune cells to an infection.
Yep.
So when that massive wave of oxidative stress hits, it leads to the cleavage and activation of gastrumin D.
And once cleaved, the active fragment of gastrumin D physically oligomerizes in the cell membrane. It basically punches massive pores through it. The cell loses its osmotic balance, it swells, and it violently ruptures.
Wow.
This is not a silent deletion, right? This is a catastrophic inflammatory implosion. And in the context of a tumor microenvironment, inducing an inflammatory cell death is a massive clinical advantage because it has the potential to recruit the patient's own immune system to the site of the tumor, alerting it to the cancer's presence.
Wait, I want to pause on the broader protein collapse they observed alongside this implosion, specifically regarding the oncoprotein C-miker.
Oh, yes, this is fascinating.
Yeah, the data showed that when NEK2 is inhibited, the expression levels of the major viral oncoprotein LMP1 plummet, but so does the cellular oncoprotein C-mic. And we know C-mic is a notoriously difficult target in oncology.
It is. It's a transcription factor that lacks deep binding pockets,
making it historically undruggable. Right. Are you saying that by targeting NEK2, we are finding a backdoor to basically starve C-mic?
That is exactly what the data suggests, and it is a phenomenal observation.
Yeah.
Because C-mic is so structurally difficult to bind a drug to, the field has spent decades looking for synthetic lethal interactions, weak points in the cellular machinery that C-mic relies on.
Right.
The inhibition of NEK2 leads to the progressive structural degradation of C-mic in these EBV-positive cells. You're effectively collapsing the tumor's core command center without having to target the undruggable C-mic directly.
That alone would be a massive breakthrough. But they pushed the mechanism even further to address the issue of multi-drug resistance.
They did.
Because even if you cause a fiery death in a large portion of the tumor, the surviving cells often adapt and learn to survive standard chemotherapy. So the researchers mapped exactly how NEK2 dictates this resistance by looking at an ATP-binding cassette transporter protein called MRP1.
Right, MRP1. It acts as a highly efficient efflux pump embedded in the cell membrane. Its entire evolutionary purpose is to protect the cell by physically grabbing toxic foreign substances and just pumping them back out into the extracellular space, and it burns cellular energy to do so.
Okay.
Well, in these hijacked lymphomas, MRP1 is massively overexpressed.
Think of the MRP1 transporter as a heavily armed bouncer at the door of a nightclub. The chemotherapy drugs arrive, trying to get inside to do their job, and the bouncer immediately grabs them and throws them right back out onto the street.
That's a perfect image.
Yeah, the drugs never reach a therapeutic concentration inside the cell.
And that is the exact mechanical barrier preventing patient recovery. What the team discovered is that NEK2 functionally stabilizes the system. When they introduced the JH295 inhibitor, it dramatically reduced both the physical expression of the MRP1 protein, meaning fewer pumps were actually built, and the functional efflux activity of whatever pumps remained.
So inhibiting NEK2 essentially fires the bouncer, boards up the doors, and traps the chemotherapy inside the club where it can finally execute its mechanism of action.
Yes. And they proved this by taking highly resistant EBV-positive cancer cells, treating them with JH295, And then applying doxorubicin, which is a standard highly potent chemotherapy agent.
And what happened?
The NEK2 inhibition completely resensitized the resistant cells. The bouncer was gone, the doxorubicin accumulated inside the cells, and the cancer was eradicated.
That completely shifts the concept of clinical dosing. If you're looking at the landscape of oncology right now, toxicity is the limiting factor.
Absolutely.
If you can use JH295 to chemically fire the tumor's bouncers, you could theoretically achieve massive therapeutic success using significantly lower, much less toxic doses of doxorubicin. It's a shift toward biological judo, like using the tumor's hijacked reliance on NEK2 against itself.
The potential for combination therapy is perhaps the most exciting clinical implication here. But, you know, translating these highly synchronized in vitro molecular interactions into a chaotic living biological system is notoriously difficult. A petri dish is a controlled environment. A living organism has drug metabolism, immune clearance, and complex tissue barriers.
Which is why their progression into advanced in vivo models is the real crucible for this research. Mm-hmm. They didn't just use standard marine models. They began with a xenograft mouse model, implanting human tumors into immunocompromised mice to test direct tumor toxicity.
Right.
But then they advanced to a highly sophisticated cord blood humanized mouse model.
And that humanized model is the absolute gold standard for studying EBV pathology before entering human clinical trials. Because Epstein-Barr is strictly a human virus, typical laboratory mice just do not get infected or present the disease in a translatable way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Researchers literally have to rebuild a functional human immune system inside the mouse using human umbilical cord blood stem cells and then introduce the virus to accurately model the human disease pathology.
Wow. And when they administered the JH295 inhibitor to these humanized living models harboring aggressive EBV-driven tumors, the data held up beautifully. The inhibitor significantly decreased the tumor burden across the board. It measurably delayed the aggressive progression of the cancer, and it dramatically prolonged the overall survival of the subjects.
And we really must emphasize the safety profile observed during these trials. Nuking a tumor in a mouse often results in severe unintended collateral damage to the host organism. However, the comprehensive destruction of these tumors occurred without any observable toxic effects on the mice's baseline organ function.
That's incredible.
Yeah, there was no severe weight loss, no hepatic failure, and no destruction of their circulating humanized immune systems.
Sparing the healthy dividing cells in the petri dish directly translated to keeping the living host safe from systemic toxicity. Seeing this unprecedented combination of high tumor lethality and low healthy tissue toxicity in an advanced living model, I mean, it forces us to fundamentally rethink clinical oncology for virally driven cancers.
It truly represents a definitive paradigm shift. For decades, the prevailing instinct in virology and oncology has been to try and target the elusive virus directly. But as we discussed, viruses are minimalist masters of evasion. Their biology shifts rapidly, rendering direct antivirals frequently obsolete.
Right.
Targeting a host cellular protein like NEK2, a fundamental piece of our own kinome that the virus relies on for structural dominance, but which the adult host can temporarily function without, is a totally different, highly stable therapeutic approach.
It's infinitely easier to target our own stable biology that we can map structurally, rather than trying to hit the virus's rapidly mutating moving target.
Precisely.
But we do have to remain grounded in the clinical reality, right? While these results in humanized models are a monumental leap, mice, even humanized ones, are not humans.
No, they're not.
The pharmacokinetics, the drug distribution, and the long-term safety profiles must be strictly verified. The next logical critical steps involve advancing these targeted NEK2 inhibitors toward rigorous phase I human clinical trials.
Absolutely. The leap from preclinical animal models to the human clinic is the steepest hurdle in medical science. We have to ensure that human biology reacts with the exact same targeted precision, clearing the tumor without triggering off-target canonic disruptions.
Right.
However, the mechanistic foundation this research team has laid, proving the direct causality between viral latency proteins, NEK2 upregulation, ROS accumulation, and multi-drug resistance, is exceptionally solid and comprehensively documented.
I have to ask you to zoom out for a second, though, and look at the broader field of virology. Could this strategy of mapping and selectively targeting the host's hijack machinery like NEK2 serve as a universal blueprint for treating other types of virus-driven cancers?
That's a huge question.
Like, could we apply this exact same logic of biological judo to HPV-driven cervical cancers? or hepatitis-driven hepatocellular carcinomas?
That is the ultimate question this research provokes, and theoretically the answer is yes. Viruses inherently do not carry a lot of their own equipment. They are obligate intracellular parasites. They absolutely must exploit the host's existing networks, specifically the kinome, to survive, replicate, and drive oncogenesis.
Right.
If we can systematically map which specific host proteins become absolutely essential only after a specific viral infection occurs, we can systematically develop targeted inhibitors for those host proteins. It is a profound therapeutic philosophy that extends far beyond EBV and non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
Let's distill all these molecular mechanisms, from the initial viral barricades to the accumulation of reactive oxygen species, the firing of the multi-drug resistance bouncers, and the clinical possibilities of combination therapies, into a single cohesive takeaway for you to remember.
The cellular kinase NEK2 serves as a vital, highly active lifeline that EBV-positive lymphomas absolutely require to survive, proliferate, and resist systemic chemotherapy. By precisely inhibiting NEK2, scientists can selectively trigger catastrophic inflammatory death in these cancer cells and dismantle their drug-pumping defenses, all while leaving healthy host tissues completely unharmed. What does this mean for the future of personalized medicine in treating virally driven, highly resistant cancers?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Midnight in the lab, bright screen, steady hand. A quiet enemy hides where the signals land. It teaches the cells how to never let go. Pumping out the cure like a practiced flow. But we trace the switch that keeps it all aglow. Follow the current, it's pulling the wires. One keynote spark, lighting bigger fire. The arm of fall when the gate goes down, the echoes call. Break the air flux, cut the line, let it burn clean. Shut the engine down, make the dark unseen. When the pumps stop running, hope gets in. Turn resistance into paper thin skin. Hit the switch, watch the tide begin. Keeps the survival song. Names on the membrane humming all night long. Beta ketonin dreaming Mike in the glow. Pro survival prayers in a brutal row. Till an iron lock inhibitor says no. Oxygen storms and a crimson flare. Inflammation rising through. The new day begins.